Good morning. Please be seated. The next case on the court's argument docket is Manuel Cecito Lopez v. State, number 61535. Mr. Anthony.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Anthony. I represent the petitioner, Manuel Lopez, in this appeal. This is a capital case from 1985 involving the death of a four-year-old girl. This is a case that was tried by the Clark County District Attorney's Office by District Attorneys Raymond Jeffers and Dan Seaton. Dan Seaton is a prosecutor that is known by this court for committing purposeful and flagrant misconduct in capital cases. In Mr. Lopez's petition, he alleges that the prosecutors committed misconduct and presented false evidence, and he further contended that he can show actual innocence of first-degree murder by means of torture. Judge Corey didn't conduct an evidentiary hearing on the merits of the claims in this petition. However, he did note that this is a case that involves whether the state would be cleaning up its dirty laundry.
Well, why didn't he conduct an evidentiary hearing? What was his reasoning?
The reasoning, Your Honor, was that...
Did he have a jury waiting out in the hall and had a big calendar of big civil case pending? What was the reason you didn't have an evidentiary hearing on a death penalty case?
There was a very limited evidentiary hearing that did occur, and it concerned the discovery of the 17 pieces of Brady material that were discovered in federal habeas corpus proceedings between 2002 and 2006. After that evidentiary hearing, the court issued a minute order. The minute order found in Mr. Lopez's favor as to the issue for which the hearing was granted, which was whether or not there was any reasonable diligence shown by the petitioner. However, the court subsequently held that all of that was for naught, because the court determined that the failure of First State Post-Conviction Counsel to discover this evidence meant that it was procedurally barred and couldn't be considered on the merits. The primary contention in this appeal is that the district court fundamentally misapprehended the cases under federal law and also the cases under state law that talk about what are the legal consequences when the state suppresses evidence. And that gets to the heart of what the district court's holding was about, is the district court held that First State Post-Conviction Counsel should have uncovered all the evidence that we uncovered in federal court. The problem with that ruling is that that ruling ignores the evidentiary picture that was before the trial court when these issues were first raised in a skeletal fashion during motions for a new trial. When motions for a new trial were filed in this case, one of them concerning the primary piece of prosecutorial misconduct in this case, it was regarding the testimony of a neighbor named Arturo Montes. And when the issue was raised about whether Arturo Montes committed perjury, Dan Seaton responded to that by submitting an affidavit to the court saying that he interviewed Mr. Montes and he had no exculpatory information to provide. He put up forward an affidavit from Mr. Montes saying that his trial testimony was truthful and that there was no there was nothing that hadn't been disclosed. And then he put on that witness up on the stand and he elicited testimony from him saying that his entire testimony was truthful. Now, getting back to Justice Cherry's question about why wasn't an evidentiary hearing allowed, the district court committed an error by relying upon that record and saying that First State Post-Conviction Counsel should have pushed forward and should have continued to look into this, these Brady allegations, even despite the fact that Judge Shearing had already heard this evidence. She had already heard the evidence that was put on. The problem with that evidence is that all that evidence is false. That's what's the difference between what happened in the post-trial period back in 1987 and what we were able to uncover during federal habeas corpus proceedings. For example, the most significant thing that we first discovered is that this witness was in jail during the events that he testified about at trial. And then we took that investigation and we went to talk to his family. And his family gave us information that totally undermines every part of his testimony. He said during trial that he was a neighbor to the Lopez family and that his son Peter was playing with the victim, Jessica. And that's how he had a foundation for his testimony. Not only was he in jail at the time, but when we interviewed his family told us he doesn't have a wife and kids. He doesn't have a son. So the entire foundation for his testimony is undone. And getting back to the question of why did the court allow a hearing, the unfortunate thing is that the court allowed the tainted evidentiary record that was created back in 1987 to basically be used as a sword, to be able to say that even despite that record, and even despite the fact that Judge Shearing had denied those motions, somehow, someway, there was an obligation on state post-conviction counsel to just suspect, based on no real evidence, that there was something more to find and that they were obligated to go find it. I'm sorry, I thought there was a question, but I'll continue.
Actually, what I was thinking about is when you do go into federal court, what does the federal court do that sends it back to us? How does it get back to the district court? And then I know how it gets to us from the district court, but how does it get from the federal court to back to the district court? What happened in the federal court?
Well, there were lengthy discovery proceedings that occurred in federal court. When we filed the federal petition in 2002, we sought discovery. And in 2002, we didn't have anything different than what was already in the state record. But we were able to tell the federal court that there's a pattern and practice in the Clark County DA's office of not disclosing material exculpatory impeachment evidence, and that there's no institutional mechanism in Metro to make sure that exculpatory information gets into the hands of the prosecutor. So we began by seeking formal discovery. The court authorized the service of those subpoenas. We litigated some of those subpoenas for several years, including most significantly the ones that were served on the district attorney's office. They didn't respond for a period of about a year. The court granted a motion to compel. The state still hadn't complied with those subpoenas. We filed a motion for an order to show cause why the state shouldn't be held in contempt. That first order was granted. Then there was a second order that we had to seek, where we had to file a second motion for an order to show cause. And finally, what happened in the end was that Judge Jones decided back in June of 2006 that there were certain pieces of material that the state needed to turn over, most significantly involving this witness that I was just talking about, Arturo Montes. Once we had all that evidence, from that point, I drafted a federal petition. And then the next thing that came up is the need to exhaust the claims that had been raised for the first time, these prosecutorial misconduct claims. There was a very brief period of time that elapsed where I was having candid discussions with the Attorney General's office about whether this would be a case that would settle. The moment that I learned that this wasn't going to be a case that would settle, I filed this state petition 4 days later. So that's the procedural history here. There were substantial federal discovery proceedings. When they concluded, a federal petition was filed, and then immediately, as soon as the informal efforts to negotiate the case failed, this petition was filed. After this petition was filed,
did the federal court enter a stay and abate order?
The answer is yes, Your Honor. The federal court did issue a stay and abeyance order. However, I didn't wait for a stay and abeyance order because, from my experience, if I am discovering a big pile of Brady information, what I know is that I need to do something with it, and I need to be back here quickly. And so while I did get that stay order that the court mentions, I didn't wait to get that stay order to file this petition. The only thing that elapsed in the meantime was I wrote the petition, and I had a brief period where I was attempting to resolve this issue with the Attorney General's office.
But the federal petition is currently stayed.
The federal petition is currently stayed and abated. This isn't just limited to this one witness who fabricated his testimony. And one thing that I want to mention is when we talk about materiality under Brady and when we talk about actual innocence, it's important to look at what the prosecutor argued and what happened in this case. The prosecutor, Dan Seaton, argued to the jury in closing that he would never have believed these fantastic allegations of torture that were raised by the mother without the corroborating testimony of Arturo Montes. In 1987, when the mother recanted her testimony and said that Mr. Lopez was at work when the child was burned in the bathtub, Dan Seaton fought against those allegations by saying that the mother's recantation was inconsistent with the trial testimony of Arturo Montes. Now the evidentiary picture before this court has been turned on its head. And that's the reason why we need to have an evidentiary hearing, is because there hasn't been a reliable determination of the facts in this case. And there's been so much that's presented that's either false, materially misleading, or that's been suppressed, that we've gone too far down this road not to hold a hearing at this point. And that's what we're asking for, is a hearing on prosecutorial misconduct and a hearing to show factual innocence of Mr. Lopez's guilt of first-degree murder by means of torture. If the court doesn't have any more questions right now, I'll sit down and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Van Bosker.
Sorry about that. May it please the court. This court should not be asked to aid and abet forum shopping. In Colley v. State, this court held that federal litigation is not good cause to ignore the state procedural bars. The point of Colley, if you're in federal court, get what you need and get into state court as quick as you can. That's not what happened here. Defense perceived the federal forum as more favorable for its discovery litigation. We know this because at the June 1st, 2010 argument, Mr. Pichetta told the court, "I mean no offense to Your Honor or to any other judge of this court, but we get discovery in federal court." And we know they wanted more than they needed merely to file a state petition, because at the December 4th, 2009 evidentiary hearing, Mr. Pichetta argued, "The question is, at what point do we have the complete evidence that underlies a cumulative Brady claim?" And in truth, they wanted to establish way more than a Brady claim. Brady's suppression prong requires suppression by the state, regardless of intent.
You deny that Arturo Montes lied? You deny that he lied when he said he had a kid and he saw the torture and all this other stuff?
As for the
you
court,
deny it?
I apologize for interrupting.
I just want to know if you deny that.
I don't have a basis of knowledge. The point is, for the procedural bars, you assume that's true. The court assumes that he lied. So for the purpose of this hearing, he lied. Whether I disagree or not, whether he truthfully lied or not, for the purpose of the hearing below, he lied.
But doesn't that go to actual innocence? I mean, we're talking about somebody who's going to be executed in this state if they ever are able to get money for a death chamber.
Before we get to actual innocence, they have to establish good cause. They have to establish they didn't sit on this for too long. They didn't wait for it. And additionally, there's other evidence in the record that would support the death penalty.
But that would make it much easier for us if there was an evidentiary hearing so that we can refer to the record and say, "Oh, look at this," or "look at that." Well, we don't have a record. I don't understand why Ken Coy, who's a former federal PD, was the first federal public defender in this jurisdiction, would deny an evidentiary hearing in this matter.
Because that's the state of the law currently. He followed the law. If you don't establish good cause, there's no basis for an evidentiary hearing. If the court wants to change the rule, the legislature has to change it. He worked within the forum that he was given, the format he was given. But we know that defense wanted to prove way more than a Brady claim, because at the December 4th, 2009 evidentiary hearing, Mr. Anthony testified as a witness, and he told the judge below, "I wanted to establish the degree of culpability by the prosecutor." The district court below found that this petition could have and should have been filed no later than 2004. Of the 17 pieces of evidence mentioned in the opening brief, defense had all of them no later than 2002 to 2004, except for three. The first of those was the Nevada law enforcement tracking document. They got that in July of 06. The point was to show that Montez lied on a driver's license application. But back in 2004, they had a declaration from Montez saying everything I testified to was a lie. The second document they didn't have was the 2006 declaration of the investigating detective. The point there was to nail down exactly how he came in contact with Montez. But again, 2004, declaration from Montez saying everything I said was a lie. The final document was the August 29th, 2006 deposition of the testifying hair expert. The point there was to confront him with the bench notes and report of the non-testifying expert. They had those in 2002 and 2004. This record absolutely fails to show good cause because defense failed to engage in due diligence. In the context of the procedural bars, the Brady suppression prong asks, why wasn't this claim brought sooner? Where the state is at fault, courts talk about suppression. Where defense is at fault, courts talk about a lack of due diligence. Now, in their reply brief, defense cites to the Sixth Circuit 2013 Tavera opinion to trump our reliance on the Sixth Circuit's 2008 Bell due diligence case. Defense argues that Tavera is the Sixth Circuit's mea culpa on due diligence. They pull the best quote they can find out of the case, put it on page 9 of the reply brief. That's footnote 4 of Tavera, where the Sixth Circuit directly addresses the difference in outcome between Tavera and Bell. The note doesn't say due diligence is dead. It doesn't say that Bell is overruled. It says the cases are different on the facts. Tavera, suppression because the information was exclusively in the possession of the state. Bell is due diligence because defense could have found it based on public records available to them. This court has obviously repeatedly relied on due diligence to dispose of Brady claims, and in Ripo v. State, you sourced it to multiple federal court of appeals opinions, all of which are good law today. Nor can defense escape the failure of due diligence by saying, we didn't investigate because we relied on an open file policy. At trial, the state didn't say don't investigate. What the state said was, you can have everything we have. If you know of its existence, you don't have to waste your time subpoenaing it. Clearly willing to be helpful, but expecting defense to investigate. And that's exactly what trial counsel did. At the November 89 evidentiary hearing, trial counsel testified that pre-trial, he subpoenaed records, he consulted with a forensic pathologist, he consulted with mental health experts, and he tested the bracket from which Jessica was hung. Certainly by the post-trial motions phase, 85 to 87, not a scintilla of reliance. Defense independently investigates Montez and Maria and interviews the detective and is arguing that the attorney general should investigate the DA's office for false statements. This record absolutely demonstrates a failure of due diligence by defense. What are their three Brady areas? Maria, Montez, and the forensic hair evidence. Maria, they want to say she lied and got benefits. At trial, they were aware that she received immunity, got INS benefits, that families of murder victims was present at trial. By 87, they have her alleged recantation. And by February 2004, they have the informal interview tape, which corroborates and is consistent with her trial and grand jury testimony. As to Montez, they wanted to call him a liar and a criminal. At trial, Kevin Kelly, the trial attorney, argued that Maria's uncle put him up to testify falsely. And by the post-trial period, in 87, trial counsel has pulled a scope on Montez and has had contact with a cellmate. The forensic hair evidence, that helped defense. Their theory at trial was that Maria, the little girl who had been abused by being whipped with a belt and having her hair pulled, grew up into Maria, the abusive mother, who whipped Jessica with a belt and pulled her by the hair. But the expert said the hair was Jessica's helped that theory because it pointed to Maria as the abuser and thus likely the killer. To the extent defense wanted to undermine that theory, Kevin Kelly was aware of the non-testifying expert at trial, and defense had the bench notes in 2004 and the report in 2002. As to the Ninth Circuit's recent Riley case, the court there was concerned with the state's heavy reliance on Caslin. The court noted that the state quoted the instruction verbatim, repeatedly argued and paraphrased it. The Ninth Circuit contrasted that with Babb, where the court found harmless error as to Kaslan, because that jury, despite only having a general verdict form, had been specifically instructed on felony murder, and that was the only theory the state argued. This case is the mirror image of Babb. This jury was instructed on torture murder, and that is the only theory the state argued. Also, the Ninth Circuit was specifically concerned with the facts of Riley, that it cried out for a deliberation instruction. Riley smoked crack cocaine at the time of the murder and was emotionally distraught, crying and talking about how he didn't want to live with dope anymore. Contrast that with the facts here. Lopez tortured this little girl for weeks. There's no indication he was intoxicated, and he certainly wasn't crying. This was his version of potty training. As to actual innocence of the death penalty, even if the court should find one of the aggravators invalid, on this record it's harmless error. Lopez was absolutely eligible for the death penalty on these facts. He tortured Jessica for weeks. He left her body bruised and broken. He whipped her with a belt, hung her by her hair, flung her into a toilet and said, "This is where people go," plunged her into cold water, and burned her with 150-degree water. Nor is he actually innocent.
Now, who testified as to those facts?
Maria testified to the facts. However, the burns were corroborated by the medical testimony, as well as the bruising and marking of with the belt and the pulled hair.
And Montez testified to the torture, too?
Montez, the only thing Montez testified to was that at a prior point in time, he saw in a playground area when Jessica wouldn't listen, he saw him lift her up by the hair and walk home. That's the extent of his corroborating testimony.
Did anything come out in the first and second post-conviction reliefs that is helpful to the state in this issue? In other words, in the first and second, this was the third post-conviction relief. So what about the first and second post-conviction reliefs? That was pre-federal public defender intervention, correct?
I believe Mr. Pichetta actually represented him on the second federal petition as well. But anyway, what's your question?
Well, the idea is there anything that would negate actual innocence in the first and second post-conviction reliefs?
Unfortunately, the federal public defender didn't get around to interviewing Montes. I think they found him in prison in California in 2002, and they don't get a declaration from him until 2004. So this is the first time I believe this has come up in the litigation.
And I've known Dan Seaton since we both passed the bar in 1970. I started as a PD, he started as a DA. I cannot believe that he would put Montes on if he had information that he was lying. I just know Dan Seaton. Maybe he did some things, but he didn't do something like this ever with me. And I had numerous cases with him, so I don't want you to fall over that I'm defending Dan Seaton. But I just wanted you to know that.
It's still in my heart.
As to the allegation made by the federal public defender about Dan.
I appreciate that.
I just had to say that.
I appreciate that.
As an officer of this court, too.
As to actual innocence of the death penalty, of the offense itself, Maria was absolutely credible. Her trial testimony matched the physical evidence from the medical examiner, and it was corroborated by the photographs. The pictures show almost straight line burns along the bottom, Jessica's bottom and the backs of her legs. No burns on her chest, her torso, her arms. But on her upper arms, bruise marks like fingerprints that indicate she'd been held. Maria's trial testimony was so credible that Kevin Kelly gave up putting on a penalty hearing just to prevent the jury from hearing from her again. But more importantly, on the day of his arrest, Lopez offers his accidental injury excuses to the police. They say it doesn't fit the facts. He says, "Go ahead and shoot and kill me. I know you want to. I deserve it." Those are not the words of an actually innocent man. The state would request the court affirm the ruling below. Thank you for your time.
Any questions for counsel? All right. Mr. Anthony?
I'd like to start with the factual assertions made by the state regarding the law enforcement tracking printout, because that brings up an interesting issue. That was skeletally identified in a privilege log back in 2004, and I demanded that the state provide that evidence to me, and I was told, number one, that it wasn't Brady material, and number two, I was told that they wouldn't give it to me without a federal court order. That is an unstated policy by the Clark County District Attorney's Office when we litigate these habeas petitions. They do not turn over anything unless a court forces them to do so. Now, the reason that's significant is because they aren't actually required by Judge Jones to turn that over until June 28th of 2006. He's not adequately addressing the import of that document. That's the document showing that Dan Seaton knew where Montez was and knew that he wasn't a neighbor, that he was in a trailer park, and that he was staying there under an alias. So when we talk about reasonable diligence, we need to look at who knew where Montez was. Why didn't Dan Seaton tell Kevin Kelly where he was when Kevin wrote the letter to Mr. Seaton saying, I want you to find this guy for me. I want you to tell me his home address. There was no response to that inquiry. So when we talk about why things didn't come out earlier, it was because this guy was being hidden under an alias in a trailer park. This guy was presented at trial under an alias. So how can we expect Kevin Kelly, how can we expect trial counsel to uncover this evidence when he can't find the witness? It was only Dan Seaton that knew where he was. So it's my contention that this evidence that they didn't disclose until July 5th of 2006 is a lot more significant than they're talking about today.
But knowing who a witness is doesn't necessarily mean that you know that he's lying on the stand.
That's true.
You know, again, the benefit of the doubt in this. I mean, of course they want to protect their witnesses. I don't blame the DA, you know, in situations where you're dealing with capital murder, to protect a witness. But that doesn't mean that he knew that this guy was going to fabricate on the stand.
Well, one thing I can say is that when you talk about what a prosecutor knows or should know, they should know what a person's home address is.
Well, counsel, I guess even if I were to accept everything that you say to be true with respect to Mr. Montez or whatever, in fact, his identity becomes to be known as, there was far more evidence that was presented at trial. Mr. Montez was almost peripheral to other evidence.
Well, again, the way that I would start by addressing that, Your Honor, is I would start by looking at Dan Seaton's closing argument. He told the jury that he would not have believed this murder by torture case if it was just Mom. He said that Montez provided critical corroboration. Furthermore, when he addressed Mr. Lopez's testimony, he said that Mr. Lopez's testimony denying knowing Mr. Montez was false, and it was evidence that he tortured Jessica. On direct appeal, this court called Montez a key prosecution witness. So you don't need to take my word for it about how important Montez was. I say we take Dan Seaton at his word. He said that this wasn't a conviction that could stand up without Montez as a corroborating witness. And the other thing is, we're not just talking about the trial. When we look at Brady and materiality, we also need to look at the materiality of it as to the motions for new trial. Does anyone here believe that the motion for new trial that alleged that Montez committed perjury, that it wouldn't have helped trial counsel to know that he did commit perjury? Or when Maria recanted her testimony and said that Manuel Lopez was at work at the time, and Dan Seaton argued against it by saying that her recantation was inconsistent with Montez's testimony?
It was also inconsistent with some of the neighbors' testimony who testified that they only heard the arguing and the loud music at the time that your client was at home.
And I think that's an important point, too, Your Honor, because, again, I think that also supports the argument that Montez's testimony was false, because the actual neighbors who were neighbors had never seen Jessica before. And so that's why it shows how important Montez was. And Montez talked about incidents that occurred all the way back in November of 1984. So when we talk about a battered child syndrome and we talk about a course of conduct, he provides the very first example that any of us can look at and say, yeah, this guy was really abusing his kid. So we all know how devastating that can be when we're talking about the death of a 4-year-old girl. It's my contention that we need to have an evidentiary hearing, and there needs to be someone sorting out the facts here. The state should have to clean up its dirty laundry. Any other questions?
Apparently not. Mr. Anthony, thank you very much for your arguments. Mr. Ambosher, thank you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.